This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Airstrikes cut power and water supplies to hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians. That is part of what the country's president called an expanding Russian campaign to drive the nation into the cold and dark and make peace talks impossible. President Volodymyr Zelensky said nearly a third of Ukraine's power stations have been destroyed in the past week alone, causing massive blackouts. The mayor of one city said that it was without electricity and water after a double missile strike on Tuesday on an energy facility. Authorities said missile strikes also hit an energy facility in Kyiv and severely damaged another in the south central city of Dnipro. Meanwhile, along the front lines, things remain very difficult for Russian troops in the southern region of the city of Kherson. That's according to Russia's new commander. He told reporters in Moscow that the Russian military would help evacuate civilians ahead of an expected Ukrainian offensive. A French cement company has agreed to U.S. fines totaling roughly $778 million over payoffs it made to Islamist terrorist groups. European leaders also entered a crucial period in which to ensure their struggling economies do not become further damaged by high energy prices and short supplies. South Korea says that North Korea has fired artillery shells near the rival's sea boundary in its latest weapons test. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says that North Korea fired about 100 shells off its west coast and 150 rounds off its east coast Tuesday night. This is VOA News. The family of an American citizen arrested in Saudi Arabia now says that he was tortured and sentenced to 16 years in prison over tweets that he sent while he was in the United States. The 72-year-old retired project manager, who was living in Florida at the time, was arrested last November while visiting a family in the kingdom. He is a citizen of both Saudi Arabia and the U.S. His son, who went public with the details in the case this week, said Tuesday that his father was sentenced on terrorism charges related to the tweets that he made. In addition, he appears to be the latest in a series of recent cases in which Saudis receive long jail sentences for social media places and pieces that were critical of the government. Airstrikes cut power and water supplies to hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians as part of our top story. That is part of what the country's president has called an expanding Russian campaign to drive the nation into the cold and dark and make peace talks difficult altogether. And the president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has said that a third of Ukraine's power stations have been destroyed in the past week alone. And it has caused massive blackouts as a result. A prosecutor on Tuesday described rape allegations by three women against that 70 show actor Danny Masterson from two decades ago that contained some of the same disturbing elements. It said that his opening statement in the trial, one of them said he dragged her to his bed where she regained consciousness to find him having sex with her. Masterson's lawyer said the reasons the allegations had so much in common is that alleged victims violated a detective's warning not to talk about the case that was very specific to the child. The federal government has announced a program to provide $1.3 billion in debt relief for about 36,000 U.S. farmers who have fallen behind on loan payments or face foreclosure. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced the Farm Loan Relief Program, funded by $3.1 billion set aside in the Inflation Reduction Act, allocating toward assistance to stressed borrowers of direct or guaranteed loans administered by the USDA. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, October 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russia airstrikes cut power and water supplies to hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians.
Second day in a row this week that Russian forces is shelling Ukrainian critical infrastructure. Today, the city of Kyiv again woke up with the sounds of explosions.
The U.S. vows to, quote, vigorously enforce sanctions, unquote, on Tehran after Russia uses Iranian-made drones to attack Ukraine.
They have not been truthful and deny providing weapons to Russia for use in Ukraine. According to these new reports, Iran is considering selling still more destructive weapons to support an invasion.
And a new study suggests mosquito bites can be traced to have an individual smells. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Airstrikes cut power and water supplies to hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians. That's part of what the country's president called an expanding Russian campaign to drive the nation into the cold and dark and make peace talks impossible. President Volodymyr Zelensky said nearly a third of Ukraine's power stations have been destroyed in the past week, causing massive blackouts. Reporter Anna Chernikova updates Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller.
Second day in a row this week that Russian forces is shelling Ukrainian critical infrastructure. Today, the city of Kyiv again woke up with the sounds of explosions. This time it was the left bank of the city, one of the biggest power plants on that side of the city. What we know for the moment that there were at least three hits at the energy facility. For the moment, there is a problem with electricity in that district and also in some parts of Kyiv region. But Kyiv's mayor Vitaly Klitschko just reported an hour ago that this electricity train is back in order. So the rescue operation and repair works are going on and situation is getting a bit better. But still, for the moment, we know that the district electricity cut and also water supply cut. So people are asked to have more drinking water at home just in case. In general, situation in Kyiv is stable. So the right bank of the city was not affected today. Also, what we know from today's attack that at least three people were killed. These people were the workers of this an energy facility.
That's reporter Anna Chernikova speaking with Flashpoint Ukraine Steve Miller from Kyiv. The Biden administration said Monday it would, quote, vigorously enforce sanctions, unquote, on Tehran after Russia used Iranian-made drones to attack Ukraine. The White House also expressed doubt that a nuclear deal negotiations impasse could be quickly resolved and protesters inside Iran are still pushing back against the hardline government. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
In the skies over Kyiv, a new threat, this time from Iran. Ukraine says that's who made some of the deadly drones that Russia used to attack the capital. Iran denies it. The Kremlin isn't commenting. In Washington, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre addressed VOA's questions about the Iranian-made drones and how the U.S. will respond.
They have not been truthful about this and deny providing weapons to Russia for use in Ukraine. Meanwhile, according to these new reports, Iran is considering selling still more destructive weapons to support an invasion they claim to oppose. Now, what we're doing here, we'll continue to vigorously enforce U.S. sanctions on both the Russian and Iranian arms trade. That's what we'll do from here. Make it harder for Iran to sell these weapons to Russia.
But analysts say there's not much more the West can do to isolate Iran. Anthony Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies served as a U.S. diplomat in Iran. He spoke to VOA on Zoom.
If it comes to consequences, about all you can do is the same thing you've already been doing for months, which is you can pick the individuals and the corporations and the commands that are providing and buying these systems and using them. And you can single people out for sanctions. At this point in time, that has very limited effectiveness.
The U.S. government has also been notably outspoken about a wave of unrest that has swept Iran after the death in September of a young woman while in the custody of the country's morality police. Jennifer Covito is Deputy Assistant Secretary for Iran, Iraq, and Public Diplomacy. She spoke to VOA's sister network, the Arabic language Al-Hura TV.
The eyes of the world are rightly on the brave protesters in Iran right now who are
standing up and speaking out for their rights, not just the rights of women, but their overall human rights. And the United States stands with them as they do that. We've taken a number of steps in recent days and weeks to hold the regime accountable for the actions that we've seen.
That includes, she said, sanctions against high-level Iranians and also U.S. communications support to Iranians so they can communicate with each other and access a range of media. The White House also appears concerned that a delicate nuclear deal negotiated over months between Western negotiators and Tehran may be stalled.
As of now, we don't see a deal coming together anytime soon.
Analysts say the deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, has been in peril since Iran's 2021 election brought in a hardline president.
The JCPOA was in very, very serious trouble since the Iranian election. Basically, Iran has had some degree of democracy and dissent. Its government has, to some extent, been more tolerant than its clerics up till now. The current president is, to all intents and purposes, a cleric and extremely conservative.
So what now? The U.S. says Iran's leadership needs to budge. And so do protesters in the Iranian cities of Tehran, Hamadan, Rasht, and Isfahan, as well as demonstrators in Beirut, Santiago, Chile, Rome, Jerusalem, and here in Washington. Anita Powell, VOA News, The White House.
Thank you, Anita. Britain's Prime Minister Liz Truss is scrambling to recover her grasp on power after her economic plans were ripped and repudiated by a Treasury chief whom she was forced to appoint to avoid a meltdown of the financial markets. Truss remains in office largely because her Conservative Party is divided over how to replace her. Britain's press is unusually united in the opinion that Truss is doomed. One tabloid is taking bets on whether she will outlast a head of lettuce and has set up a live stream of the vegetable so people can watch. For more, I spoke with Anand Menon, Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London and Director of the UK in a Changing Europe Initiative.
They made some pretty basic errors in presenting their budget, which was essentially rejected by the market, and made interest rates in this country higher than they would have been otherwise. And I think the sight of a prime minister doing damage to the economy was fatal. But I think the second thing, and the longer-term thing, is that you've got a Conservative Party that is fundamentally divided over economic policy. So having a weak and unstable party behind her has contributed not only to the plight of Liz Truss, but also, I think, to the fact that even though I think her MPs know she needs to go, they can't decide on who should replace her.
Talking about an option of who should replace the Prime Minister if she goes, is there an opening for former Prime Minister Theresa May, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson? Do they have a chance, or is the Tory party looking for a fresh face?
That depends on who you mean by the Conservative Party, and here there's an interesting distinction. I think Tory MPs will be very reluctant to have Boris Johnson back. It was Conservative MPs, after all, who got rid of him in the first place. On the other hand, there still seems to be, from some polling, and this polling is generally not massively accurate because it's hard to poll party members, but there's been some polling that shows that Boris Johnson is the most popular candidate amongst Conservative Party members. So one of the big questions around the replacement of Liz Truss is who gets to choose her successor and what process do they use. And one of the reasons why she seems to be set for the very short term at least is because her MPs can't agree on a process that would exclude party members and therefore exclude the possibility of Boris Johnson coming back.
Does this then open up an opportunity for the Labour Party, since the Conservatives are just divided about who to take over, about policies, about the economy?
Well, absolutely. I mean, put this in an American perspective. If one of the Democrats or the Republicans were in the process of self-destructing, then the other side would have an advantage as a result. And I think that's the same here, is there are those who criticise the Labour Party for not having a strong enough or clear enough message about what it would do if it was elected. But as long as the Conservative Party keeps sort of suffering from these self-inflicted wounds, then yes, Labour will be the party that benefits. And we're seeing that very strongly in the polling now.
That's Anand Menon, Professor of European Politics and Foreign Affairs at King's College London and Director of the UK in Changing Europe Initiative. He spoke with me from London. UNICEF warns that an unprecedented number of children are likely to die in drought-stricken, famine-prone Somalia without greater immediate action from the international community to provide life-saving assistance. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Somalia has endured four consecutive years of failed rains and is facing a possible fifth season of drought. This has destroyed people's ability to feed themselves and has forced millions to uproot themselves in search of something to eat and essential basic relief. The humanitarian crisis is having a particularly disastrous impact on children. UNICEF reports the number of severely acutely malnourished children is skyrocketing. In August alone, it reports that 44,000 children with severe acute malnutrition were admitted to health facilities for emergency treatment. Speaking from Dolo, Somalia, UNICEF spokesman James Elder says this means today in Somalia, a child is admitted to a health care facility every single minute of every single day.
Four severely acutely malnourished children are 11 times more likely to die of diarrhea and measles and so on than well-nourished children. So with rates like those I've mentioned, Somalia really is on the brink of a tragedy at a scale not seen in decades. And of course, the children behind what is a staggering, slightly appalling statistic are those who make it to a treatment centre.
Elder notes that many people are prevented from getting the help they need because of ongoing instability in the country and the dangers posed by the Islamist militant Al-Shabaab group. In response, he says UNICEF is deploying mobile teams to find and treat malnourished children in hard-to-reach locations.
When people speak of the crisis facing Somali and Somalians today, it's become very common to make these frightful comparisons to the famine, of course, of 2011, when around 260,000 people, half of those children, died. However, everything I'm hearing on the ground, from nutritionists to famine experts to pastoralists, is that things today actually, unfortunately, look worse.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs estimates 7.8 million people in Somalia are affected by the drought, including more than 1.1 million displaced people. OCHA reports famine is projected in Baidoa and Buhakaba districts in Bay region between now and December if humanitarian aid does not reach people most in need. As of now, 45% of the UN's $2.26 billion appeal has been funded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In other news, if mosquitoes love you, new research suggests it may be because of how you smell. A study published Tuesday finds that people who are, quote, mosquito magnets, unquote, have high levels of certain chemicals on the skin that are tied to odor. Scientists pitted against people's smells against each other in a lab and saw that bugs swarm to the same hosts over time. Bad news, though, for the mosquito magnets is how to change your skin acid levels. But some scientists hope the new research can help think up new ways to fight off bites. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Dwafo in Washington. Arab Americans in Northern Virginia have been active in the American political scene. 32 years ago, they established the New Dominion Political Action Committee, which organized Arab American Candidates Night, allowing candidates for U.S. Congress from both parties to present their programs directly to the voters. Ayman Eldawish, a member of the organizing committee, explains to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shinawi the importance of these nights, especially for the upcoming midterm elections next month.
We believe that Arab Americans have to have a voice in politics in the state of Virginia, and that's why we organized and put together very strong activists who are committed to the Arab American community and make sure that the voice of Arab Americans is represented in the state of Virginia.
How important is to involve Arab Americans in the public offices and in the political scene?
It's very important that Arab Americans run for office. And we've had in the past Arab Americans run for office. Right now we have Abra Romesh, who is a member of the school board. She's run for office successfully. And in the past we've also had other Arab Americans who have left office. But we continue to seek candidates who are willing to run for office in any capacity they can. Arab Americans are important to exist and we make sure that they are represented, whether in person as a member of the community or their voices reach the legislature in Richmond.
How crucial is Arab American participation in this particular midterm election?
In this particular midterm elections, we have four candidates running for the U.S. Congress. It's Don Beyer, Jerry Connolly, Herb Smith, and Jennifer Wex, and they're all attending here, and they're all listen to us, and they all have their offices open to any Arab American that needs help or has an opinion. And we always advocate for Arab interests in their offices.
So do you invite both parties?
Candidates' dinner is both parties. The NDPAC represents all Arab America, but we do have Democratic activities and we have Republican activities. And those of us who work with the organizing team invite Republican candidates, and this is the first time they do it. In the past, I invited candidates on both sides. So this year, we hope that the Republicans will be represented as well as Democrats, but mostly in the past, it was attended by Democrats.
That's Eamon Eldawash, a member of the organizing committee of the Arab Americans in Northern Virginia, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shinawi. Ethiopian government forces and their allies have captured the city of Shere and two more towns in the Tigray region in an offensive that aims to take control of airports and federal infrastructure. The attack has been met with international calls for an immediate ceasefire and for neighboring Eritrea to withdraw troops from the region. The fighting has also dashed hopes for African Union-led peace talks. Mohamed Yusuf reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi.
After more than 7 weeks of renewed fighting, Ethiopian government forces, allied militias and Eritrean troops are taking territories from the Tigray rebel group in the north of the country. In a statement, the Ethiopian government says its forces have taken control of Alamata, Korem and Shire City in the Tigray region and will coordinate with aid groups to get aid into those areas. The rebel Tigray People's Liberation Front acknowledged losing ground to the government troops but said it will defend itself against the enemies. William Davison is International Crisis Group senior analyst for Ethiopia. He says continued fighting and increased violence against civilians are likely.
Shire is the second largest city, somewhat strategic, at something of a crossroads, potentially making it easier to advance towards Aksum and Adwa. It also has a major road south leading from it, so a strategic and psychological boost. But of course, we're yet to see how quickly this advance will continue. It's possible there'll be some rapid advance towards Mekelle, or there could be resistance along the way that prevents that.
On Monday, the Ethiopian government said it was seeking to take control of critical infrastructure in the region, including airports and communications facilities. The war in Tigray is nearing the two-year mark with no sign of peace in sight. In August, the conflict resumed after 5 months of truce. Davison says planned peace talks between the TPLF and the government may be for naught if the government asserts authority in Tigray.
It isn't clear who they would be negotiating with if they succeed. So it looks more like 2020 rather than 2022, meaning that in 2022 there's been a focus on a negotiated settlement before the resumption of conflict. But like I say, if they're trying to take control of all of Tigray, it isn't clear who they will be negotiating with at the end of it.
This month's planned peace talks in South Africa and other peace processes failed to launch as the sides continue to disagree on the venue and mediators of the reconciliation efforts. The head of the Horn Institute for Strategic Studies, Hassan Khananji, says all means possible need to be used to bring the factions to the negotiating table.
It's important that the parties also present mediators who are going to appear at least to be impartial or neutral to both parties. Part of the challenge in recent months has been the perception that some mediators may not exactly be neutral. It's going to be important that the framework of mediation also involves a degree of carrots and sticks to ensure that spoilers are not going to have their way, because without the ability to enforce the agreement, of course, it's going to be violated.
Khananji adds that without some incentives for the parties just to come to the table, both sides may be reluctant to negotiate at all. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including the Biden administration said it will continue to vigorously enforce sanctions against Iran after Russia dropped Iranian-made drones over Ukraine's capital in a series of deadly attacks over the weekend. We'll examine this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. What is the future of the British monarchy overseas now that King Charles III is taking the reins from his more popular mother? Charles is facing a growing degree of anti-royal sentiment, not only from several Caribbean countries, which experienced colonialism and slavery, but also from countries like Australia and New Zealand. The future of the British monarchy overseas. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs program, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedofa in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States hosted the first ever U.S. Pacific Islands Country Summit to build on the commitment to the people of the Pacific. The Pacific Islands and the United States have long-standing trade and diplomatic relationships. In addition to protecting the security of the region, the United States is also committed to combating the dangers of climate change. At the summit, President Joe Biden stressed the importance of strengthening these partnerships.
We're seeing the consequences of climate change around the world very vividly, including in the United States right now. And I know your nations feel it acutely.
However, preparing for climate change is a complex challenge, noted Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Building resilience is about more than equipping communities to adapt to the effects of climate crisis, which for many of you, is an existential threat. It's also about preparing communities to weather a wide range of interrelated shocks that we know have caused cascading effects.
To that end, President Biden has announced $810 million in expanded programs to improve the lives of Pacific Islanders. These investments include preparing for climate impacts on health and food security and building early warning capacity to predict, prepare for, and respond to climate hazards. Secretary Blinken also discussed plans to strengthen marine livelihoods by supporting fisheries, aquaculture, and tourism as part of the Resilient Blue Economies program. The blue economy refers to the sustainable use of ocean resources for economic growth, improved livelihoods, and jobs while preserving the health of ocean ecosystems. The United States also joined Australia, Japan, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom in the first Partners of the Blue Pacific Ministerial. Together, these countries met with members of the Pacific Islands Forum to discuss how to efficiently develop and bolster the Pacific Islands government and economies in line with PIF's 2050 strategy for the Blue Pacific continent. The United States is committed to deepening the relationship with the Pacific Island countries and helping them prepare for future climate hazards that threaten the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.